Lecture 14, Northwest and North India.
Much of what we consider the classical age of Brahmanic Hinduism and Sanskrit-based culture occurred in North India during the impressive Gupta Empire of the 4th to 6th centuries CE. Those emperors patronized many advances in Indian, especially Hindu, religion and arts. For example, Sanskrit literature reached an aesthetic peak in epic poetry, theater, and divine histories during that period. But this towering Gupta political and cultural peak should not obscure the fascinating history that developed over the previous 4 centuries since the fragmentation of the Mauryan Empire in the 2nd century BCE. And we should not overlook the significant events going on around the Gupta Empire as Central Asian ethnic groups migrated into India, established kingdoms, and assimilated. Nor should we forget the subsequent processes in North and Northwest India over the following centuries when the society, culture, and economy all continued to develop. In the last lecture, we considered the Deccan and peninsular South India during the same millennium following the fragmentation of the Mauryan Empire in the 2nd century BCE. Now we can concentrate on developments within and between India's other 2 macro regions. On the Gangetic Plain, the expanding agricultural and trade-based economy supported social and cultural changes that powered the Gupta Empire and other expansive states. In the Northwest, martial and peaceful immigrants from Central Asia periodically entered the Indus Plain, linking India by land with other Asian lands and the Mediterranean. We will selectively note and illustrate ongoing processes and outstanding events in these 2 macro regions during these 10 centuries. Our knowledge and understanding of this early period of Indian history, however, necessarily remains somewhat incomplete and even speculative. There is little architecture and few surviving artifacts from these 2 macro regions that we can study to learn about the culture and technology of that time. The scattered historical sources that have survived do provide brief highlights on aspects of this period's culture, and especially on some of its rulers. But such surviving evidence is not always due to the ruler's special prominence. Sometimes what has lasted is the result of chance. Foreign travelers may have happened to pass through his kingdom, for example, and left us descriptions of that ruler and his domain. More materially, a hoard of coins accidentally lost and later discovered by chance can tell us the names and titles of rulers whose coins were included. The Indian economy was expanding its monetization, so there were more coins in circulation. As they developed, Indian coins did not customarily have a ruler's or a god's portrait, although some had a king or a deity doing something like riding into battle. Clearly, the religious symbols included would indicate the affiliation of the ruler. Also, the quality of the coins in terms of the purity or debasement of the gold or silver tells us about that kingdom's fiscal conditions. Their size, shape, text, and images indicate the ruler's cultural identifications. How they were minted tells us about local technology. Evidence about trade connections is also preserved. For example, the date, number, and condition of the Roman imperial coins found in hoards in different regions of India can be very informative. There are fewer Roman coins found in the Kushana Empire of the Northeast, for example, than in the Deccan during the same period of the 1st to 3rd CE. That could mean either that fewer Roman coins reached the Kushanas, which is less likely, or else that the Kushanas melted down those Roman coins for their gold and silver content and then minted their own coins. Indeed, the Roman coins in the Deccan often have a gash across the face of the Roman emperor, suggesting that they circulated in the economy there, but that the local rulers rejected any suggestion they were recognizing Roman authority. Religious texts from this period also contain rich information. But as recall from our discussion of the Mahabharata, they do not follow the same conventions as Edic or Western-style post-Enlightenment histories. During this period, we do begin to see more examples of the Sanskrit Purana genre, meaning accounts of the ancient. These, however, conventionally began with the creation of the universe and highlight the origins of deities and the cycles of cosmic time. However, some of these Puranas also include genealogies of dynasties, often from a divine ancestor, and lists of the dynasty's kings. But there was no standardized chronological system in place across India, so they're often very hard to date accurately. Further, these and other texts do not usually state who the writer was, except that they were often attributed to a divine or legendary author. Kings during this period made special efforts to glorify themselves in inscriptions, some of which have survived. From the 2nd century CE, royal inscriptions tended to follow a very eulogizing style. They often vastly inflate claims, listing many more defeated or subordinated kings and regions conquered than actually occurred. Even dynastic names in inscriptions can be misleading, since many kings claimed the same ones. Occasionally, a later family might take the name of an illustrious earlier dynasty in order to claim legitimacy and longevity. This can misleadingly be taken as evidence of biological continuity instead of cultural or political imitation. None are as revealing personally as the inscriptions of the Emperor Ashoka Maurya. But the ways that rulers self-represent show some of the ideals that they desired to claim. One of the main recurrent features of the post-Mauryan millennium was the growing movement of people and commerce in and out of India through the northwest, what is today Afghanistan on one side of the mountain passes and the Indus River plain on the other. Remember that Alexander the Great's invasion of 327 BCE had destabilized the kingdoms in that region and left it a cultural shatter zone. Greek, Iranian, Central Asian, and even Chinese people and cultures overlapped with Indian ones there. Trade routes linking the Mediterranean, India, and China flourished and enriched communities and kingdoms along the way. This later became known as the Silk Road, although many different high-value products flowed along it. Today, this northwest area is broken into half a dozen modern states. Each state has a single dominant ethnic group, but actually also contains a variety of people who have lived among each other for centuries. Some of these are now commonly referred to in America as the Istans. On the western flank of this region were Iranian-based empires. The Seleucids had arisen as the successors to Alexander's Eastern Empire. But their own eastern governors or satraps in Afghanistan and the Punjab soon asserted their own autonomy. These many small kingdoms are collectively described by historians as Indo-Greek Bactrians. This suggests that they built on Indian Buddhist and also Hindu, as well as Greek and Central Asian cultures and state formations. For example, their royal and religious statues and coins combined artistic, linguistic, and clothing styles, like sculptures of the Buddha in Greek robes. Some kings even issued multilingual, multi-script coins with a Greek-style bust of the king on one side and him mounted on an Indian elephant on the other. Bringing trade, but also periodically raiding or conquering this northwest region were a series of Central Asian groups. One of these martial pastoralist groups that aggressively migrated into the northwest as far as the Indus Plain and then ruled there were the Kushanas, probably known to the Chinese as the dangerous Yuchi. The Kushanas dominated the northwest region from the 1st to the 3rd centuries. One of their most powerful early kings was Kanishka, who ruled around the end of the 1st century CE, although the dates of his reign are disputed by historians. Ganesha and his Kushana successors recognized and built their authority on the cultures of the array of people that they ruled. For example, some Kushana rulers proclaimed their royal status using Greek, Roman, Iranian, Chinese, and Indian titles simultaneously. They especially patronized Mahayana Buddhism, which had been strong in that region since the days of Emperor Ashoka. Buddhism tended to be congenial for many of the people in the region, able to adapt to their more egalitarian, tribal, social, and cultural values. By controlling key routes along the Silk Road, the Kushanas profited from trade among China, India, and Rome. Eventually, the Kushanas were subordinated during the 4th to 5th century by the Sasanian Empire of Iran, which mounted expeditions eastward, conquering into the Indus Plain. Another incoming Central Asian ethnic group were the Scythians, known in India as Ashakas. They pushed their way into northwestern India and beyond the Indus into western India, starting from the 2nd century BCE. One branch, historians call the Western Shakas, which gradually conquered much of today's Gujarat and Rajasthan. One of their kings, Rudradaman I, who ruled from 130 to 150 CE, is remembered both for his martial victories and for his efforts to establish himself within Indian society. Significantly, he commissioned at least one Sanskrit language inscription that proclaimed him a ruler in Hindu terms. But he had this carved adjacent to an older inscription by Emperor Ashoka himself. In it, Rudradaman proclaims that he repaired a dam that had been constructed centuries earlier by Ashoka, but that had fallen into disrepair. This inscription thus suggests Rudradaman's claims to Ashoka's imperial legacy, both in terms of practical effectiveness and also symbolic political terms. I mentioned in the last lecture that the Shakas fought perennially against the Tatavahanas, who ruled the Deccan and stood high in Brahmanic Hindu society. Rudradaman gave one of his daughters to the Satavahana king as a bride. This created a political marriage alliance, but in Indian cultural terms, it showed both Rudradaman's acceptance of the social and political superiority of his Satavahana son-in-law and also Satavahana acceptance of the Shakas as Hindus. Indeed, various Shaka clans and other settling ethnic groups began to assimilate into Indian Hindu society. This was usually a gradual, multi-stage process that we should examine more extensively. When a Shaka or other incoming martial clan settled unoccupied lands or conquered and ruled villagers already there, these incoming people often adapted themselves to the local, largely Hindu culture. The nature of the so-called caste system of Varnas and Jatis meant that clans could live amidst other groups while not interdining or intermarrying with them. But gradually, they connected themselves more with the local society. In doing this, some former outsider groups began to take on social and cultural characteristics recognized locally as Kshatriya. Indeed, the martial and often ruling Jati of Rajputs, literally sons of kings, was both accepted as part of the Kshatriya Varna and also a status into which powerful outsiders could assimilate. This process, you will recall, is known by social scientists as Sanskritization, since Sanskrit is the sacred language of Brahmins. Outsiders also sometimes enhanced their identification by themselves and by others as Rajputs through a two-stage process of intermarriage. First, the former outsiders would use their political power and economic resources to convince already recognized Rajput families in the region to accept brides from them. It was customary in India for women to marry upwards socially, what's called hypergamy by anthropologists. So giving their womenfolk upward, often with a substantial dowry, made the former outsiders form social bonds with established Rajputs, while at the same time recognizing the social superiority of the bride receivers. For their part, established Rajputs who accepted such brides and their dowry were demonstrating their social superiority over rising clans who had power and wealth. This was often an early step in being accepted as Rajput. The next step came when the former newcomers clearly had risen in power above already established Rajputs. They then convinced the latter to give brides to them. This provided public proof that the former outsiders were now high-ranking Rajputs, standing above the bride givers. Another component of this process of proving themselves Rajputs was a way that the upwardly mobile clan often hired Brahmins. In exchange for payment and other patronage, these Brahmins would perform royal rituals that only Kshatriyas were supposed to be eligible for. Further, some Brahmins discovered their patron's true genealogy as descended from a great Kshatriya ruler and ultimately the sun, the moon, or from a sacred sacrificial fire. As we know from Edic science, DNA testing can show biological descent. So blood or saliva for testing from people identified as Rajputs today can tell us much about male lineage from the Y chromosome, as well as maternal lineage from the mitochondrial DNA. Often clans and jatis will include males who are all very close in terms of their Y chromosome DNA. This shows the paternal pattern found in much of South Asian society. In contrast, mitochondrial DNA of the matrilineage is much more diverse. This suggests how women could marry up and into a different clan with their children being full members of that community. So various Central Asians, like the Shakas, seem to have assimilated as Rajputs, particularly in Western India, in what is today the province of Rajasthan. This pattern of eruptions into India from the northwest would continue with the Hunan. These seem to be a branch of the same people that the Chinese repulse, but then who erupted in waves as the Huns into Europe and also into India, starting in the mid-5th century CE. There is much evidence that some of these Hunan in India also Sanskritized as Rajputs, even as they repeatedly pushed down the Ganges against kingdoms there, most notably against the Gupta Empire. Over the centuries following the fragmentation of the Mauryan Empire and the collapse of the Shunga dynasty, the Gangetic plain was the arena in which various regionally based dynasties arose, attempted to expand, and then either fragmented or shrank back to their core region. Eventually, the most prominent and successful of these were the Guptas. This dynasty arose from uncertain origins, established their regime in still wealthy Magadha, and built an empire starting in the early 4th century CE. The Gupta Empire lasted powerfully for 200 years in the face of recurrent invasions by Central Asians. Our attention is drawn to the Guptas not only for their political and military accomplishments, but also because of the flourishing Sanskrit and Hindu culture under their patronage. The actual origins of the Gupta dynasty remain obscured, perhaps intentionally so by these rulers. Some evidence suggests that they were Vaishya merchants from either the upper Ganges region or from Bengal. But they began their real rise to power when a dynamic Gupta general named Chandragupta I married into the Lakavi clan that was dominant near Magadha around 320 CE. Once in control of the rich resources of Magadha, Chandragupta stood forth as a king and began a decade of conquest that his four successors would gradually expand over the next 200 years. In addition to being effective military commanders, the Guptas succeeded in their conquest by recruiting huge armies, mostly bow-armed infantry. The Magadha region supplied iron ore, abundant coal, and metallurgy technology to make steel longbows, in addition to the more traditional bamboo ones. These steel bows did not warp in the humidity of the monsoon. They could also drive an arrow accurately over long distances with great penetrating power. Further, the jungles of the lower Ganges plain are a prime habitat for elephants, which a series of victorious Gupta kings and commanders armored and rode into battle. As Gupta power rose, they made ever more pretentious claims through their escalating titles. Gupta rulers began to call themselves the Supreme Lord, the Great King of Kings, and the Most Worshipful One. Their inscriptions listed their victories. Indeed, Samudragupta, who ruled 335 to 375, had a long list of his triumphs of over 40 different kings and kingdoms inscribed on an Ashokan pillar in Allahabad, indicating that he exceeded even Emperor Ashoka. At its greatest extent, the Gupta Empire stretched over the entire Ganges Plain. Tributary kings recognized Gupta overlordship as far west as the Indus River and as far south as Kanchipuram. The Guptas also made marriage alliances that extended their power. For example, in the 5th century, one Gupta princess, Prabhavati, married the current king of the Vataka dynasty in the Western Deccan. When her husband died, Prabhavati took over as regent, ruling that kingdom as a Gupta ally while her son grew up. Within this vast territory under direct and indirect Gupta authority, commerce and culture expanded, benefiting many. The economy continued to monetize, which enriched bankers and moneylenders. More trade came with increased production of craft goods, so artisans prospered. With a need for administrators, scribes, and tax collectors, these classes also rose. As a result, urban-based culture flourished. While the core of the Gupta Empire was in Magadha, they tried to buttress their administration in the western part of the regime by making the historically significant city of Ujjain their second capital. Especially in the Gupta capital cities, royal and other patrons sponsored authors of Sanskrit literature. The two great Hindu epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, reached their final and most polished form under the Guptas. The most famous Indian playwright, Kalidasa, wrote widely admired sophisticated Sanskrit dramas, including Shakuntala, the love story between a king and his forest-raised, semi-divine princess lover. The Indian system of Ayurvedic medicine, which stressed the importance of a holistic balance of the patient's three gunas, or humors, also developed. The Shastra genre, which taught the highest lessons of Brahmanic Hinduism, also peaked, and we'll discuss this in the next lecture. Although the Guptas favored the worship of the Hindu god Vishnu, they also patronized Buddhism. Several Chinese pilgrims who traveled through the Gupta Empire in search of the original teachings of the Buddha noted the extensive system of Buddhist monasteries. One pilgrim, for example, reported that he translated 74 Indian works, some 1,335 chapters, and it required 22 horses for him to carry his books home to China. Indeed, the most famous center of Buddhist learning at Nalanda excelled in astronomy and mathematics. The concept of zero and the decimal system of numbers seem to have been discovered here in that period. For a century, the Gupta Empire repulsed repeated assaults by Central Asian Huns from the northwest. But the Gupta dynasty was drained of resources from this constant warfare and finally collapsed by 550. Over the following century, dozens of rival regionally based dynasties fought to survive and expand in North India as further martial immigrations came from the northwest. We know little about most of these groups and individuals, but one king, Harsha, emerged out of this melee and briefly created an empire that echoed Gupta accomplishments. Harsha also left far more evidence than his rivals. Harsha's family had been locally prominent as rulers of Thanesar, just one among the small and more diffuse states located between the Ganges and the Indus Plains. The Chinese visitor Yu Cheng came to India from 629 to 645. He personally met Harsha and identified his family as originally Vaishya, suggesting their non-royal origin. But the dynasty's own official claims were that they were Brahmins. Harsha got his chance at about age 16 when his older brother was assassinated around 606. So Harsha inherited his father's small kingdom. Then Harsha defeated the assassins of his sister's late husband, who was the ruler of a larger, more significant kingdom based in Kanauj. This city was a major cultural, economic, and political center of the upper Ganges Plain. With that as his base, for half a century long, Harsha led ever-growing armies against his neighbors in all directions, including conquering the still wealthy Magadha, which provided him with even more resources of men and material. Given the rapidity of Harsha's military expansion, he had only a relatively small administration that did not reach very deep into the conquered territories. Instead, Harsha had many feudatories. These were rulers who accepted his overlordship, but continued to govern in their own regions. Harsha bound some of these kings to him through political marriage alliances. Harsha's triumphs reached their southern limit, however, when he tried to invade the Deccan around 630. That campaign overextended his forces and lost to the Chalukyas, a series of rulers who had evidently largely succeeded to the territories earlier ruled by the Satavahanas. In part, we know so much more about King Harsha than about his many rivals because of the literature, including historical accounts, that flourished during his patronage. To be remembered as a ruler, it's good to give patronage to authors and visitors. One of Harsha's courtiers, the poet Bana, was a brilliant Brahmin praise singer. He glorified his patron by composing a literary biography in Sanskrit entitled Harishcharita, or The Deeds of Harsha. This was more of an historical romance than a modern-style history. In this work, Harsha is born from the sun through a miraculous conception. He then had an especially auspicious birth as a universal emperor-to-be. Both gods and humans glorify Harsha, revealing how Hindus and also Buddhists revered him. The same life story is told in light of each tradition, either the Hindu goddess Lakshmi or a Buddhist bodhisattva persuade him to accept the throne. The text ends with Harsha about to begin his glorious reign of conquest. Despite this supernatural account of Harsha's origins and early reign, this text still provides us valuable knowledge of the culture of Harsha's court and its historical context. Harsha's court evidently also produced at least one fascinating Sanskrit language play, Ratnavati. This tells the story of how a romantic king falls in love with his queen's maidservant, but she's really a princess in her own right and his official fiancée, so the love story ends well. Further, the emphasis in this play on a political marriage alliance, where a distant king gives his daughter to the king, may reflect Harsha's own policies. The official author of this undated play is called Harsha. While most scholars identify him with King Harsha of Kanauj, many also believe that he was not the actual playwright. Rather, one of his courtiers probably authored the play, but out of loyalty and perhaps hoping for royal favor, attributed it to King Harsha. Yet more knowledge about Harsha's reign comes from the Chinese pilgrims who passed through his kingdoms, seeking to find Buddhist texts and relics. But a later Chinese visitor, Wang Chuanche, an ambassador from the Tang Emperor who reached Kanauj in 647, found Harsha's throne had been usurped by his minister. This both gives us a termination date for his reign and indicates that Harsha's heirs proved unable to hold on to his throne. Instead, the Northwest and the Ganges region experienced centuries of brief conquest by a series of warrior kings. Among these were Rajputs, perhaps originally Shakas, who spread across North India from the 8th through the 10th centuries. One king from Kashmir, Aditya Muktapirda, briefly conquered much of North India between 724 and 760. Other powerful kings fought their way up the Ganges from Bengal, while yet others made incursions north from the Deccan. However, rarely could any conquering dynasty hold a trans-regional state together for more than one reign. Other kings might be willing to show ritual submission while holding on to much of their pre-existing power. But these were fragile bonds. A weakened overlord or succession meant reversion to autonomous regional rule. Nevertheless, amid this political instability, certain cultural processes continued. Prominent among them was the resurgence of Brahmanic Hinduism as it responded to various challenges. We'll consider that process in the next lecture.